to do, and it has happened in his life to what we would consider to be maybe an excess. But I think that because God loved him so much, it's kind of like you want the best, if possible, even though the Lord can see into the future. He held David to an even higher standard because of the position that he gave him. And so that's okay. David understands that. And he's lived with it. And it's not over yet in what we're going to look at this morning. On the screen, on the screen it shows chapter 20. I got a little frog this morning. of 2 Samuel. And there is, here we go again, another revolt. This time led by a man named Sheba. Sheba was a troublemaker, a noted troublemaker. And his father was Bichri, and that's noted in the passages that talk about Sheba. Sheba's not happy. He's not happy with David. Not at all. He and others who follow him, Sheba, feel a disconnect between themselves and David. David has a great following, but it's not Sheba who is part of that following. Sheba is a Benjamite from the tribe of Benjamin, or in Hebrew, Binyamin. And here's the connection. Saul was also a Benjamite. So there is that deep, deep, deep feeling that Sheba has. Sheba, again, really doesn't want any part of David. Let others have David. I'm through with him, is really his attitude. So here comes the revolt. And it's army against army. Nothing new here. The same kinds of confrontations are occurring. And Sheba actually leaves the area and goes to the city of Abel, Beth Machah. He flees to that location and enters the city, and he's inside the city walls. The army pursues him, led by the man in charge, who continues to be Joab, David's man in command. And Joab and the others decide that they're going to lay siege to the city, and they go ahead and they build a bank, which is nothing more than a large earthen ramp to gain access over the city walls. If you can imagine what that looks like, you can imagine an old fortress city or an old city, and then you have a long ramp of nothing but impacted earth that leads up to the top. They weren't using towers. They weren't using grappling hooks. They were using ramps. This same tactic was used by the Romans. If anyone has ever seen pictures or been to Masada in Israel, you will see the same ramps. The ramps are still there at Masada. It's an amazing sight. You can see the Roman ramp, just like the ramp that was built here to access this particular city. Anyway, that was the plan. And the plan was, once they entered the city, there was no life to be spared. There was no discrimination. Men, women, children, Joab and the forces were not going to be caring that much about that. He is met, Joab is, by a woman who lives within the city, who essentially is telling him and pleading and telling him at the same time that this is not a good idea. This is a terrible thing to do. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And Joab's interest really is in Sheba. He is not interested in really harming anybody. That's not his goal. His goal is to get Sheba. This is a means to an end only. And she says to him, well, we can deliver him to you. Well, she says, we can deliver part of him to you. We can deliver his head to you. Will that be sufficient? And Joab says, absolutely. Not looking to hurt anybody. And that's what happens. The Sheba revolt ends with the death of Sheba as his head is tossed out of the city so that Joab can be satisfied that it's over. Okay, but David's troubles are not quite over yet. We're going to get into what's happened with David as we flip down now to we've got chapter 21, where more trouble, not necessarily started by David, but the Lord is kind of chastising the actions of Saul, as it says here. Then there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered very specifically, it is for Saul and for his bloody house because he slew the Gibeonites. There had been a treaty between Joshua and the Gibeonites hundreds of years before, and Saul broke that treaty, and the Lord is now exacting judgment on Israel. Even though Saul is dead, the Lord does what the Lord knows is the right thing to do, and this is what happens. There is a famine. The famine passes. But it's not over yet, because now there's another war with the Philistines. Haven't we had enough of the Philistines? I know David has had enough of the Philistines. That is his last series of battles, the very last campaign. He is an old man. He's aging. He's nearing the end of his life. And this will be his last series of battles. In the midst of all of this, in chapter 22, David continues to express his love for the Lord, his gratitude, his deep, deep gratitude for his salvation. And we remember that he understands what that is. And David knows where he will go when he dies. We've seen that before when his son passed, and he knew that he would join him in heaven. And David composes, I've only excerpted it here. I haven't done the entire Song of Deliverance, but as it says here, and he said, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, the God of my rock, in him will I trust. He is my shield and savior. Thou savest me from violence. Well, he trusts him. He trusts God in the midst of everything that's happened to him, because as I said earlier, he understands the chastisements that God has enacted. He also knows that his life has been spared many opportunities for him to have been killed, but he was never killed. The Lord liveth, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of the rock of my salvation. He is the tower of salvation for his king, and showeth mercy to his anointed, meaning himself, unto David, unto his seed forevermore. It's a beautiful statement, and it's how he truly feels. This is his deep-seated love for God and his gratitude. The next chapter, 23, speaks of the last words. These are not deathbed words, okay, not to be confused with that. They're, again, he's nearing his life's end, and he's speaking on different things, and this is part of that section of his life, that ending part of his life. And here it says, the Spirit of the Lord spake by me, and his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, the rock of Israel spake to me, he that ruleth over men must be just. ruling in the fear of God, okay? He understands this. Now, maybe justice wasn't as well-honed in him as it could have been. He, David, understands so many of his faults. I mean, in reflecting on his life, it must have been at times very, very saddening. We know that he had moments of absolute tragedy, and he has been hammered, but he understands it. In the midst of it all, he loves the Lord so deeply, and the Lord loves him for that. Okay. Let me see if I can get to, I have one thing I wanted to read, which is related to this. Let me see if I can find it real quickly. You don't have to turn to this if I find it fast enough. Let's see. Got the page number. If I could just get to the passage. Getting close. Getting close. Okay. One more page and I'll be there. Okay. I'm going to read. What I've done here is where it says the last words of David, I've picked up verses 2 and 3 for you. But I wanted to read a little bit more. I wanted to read verse 1 in particular, and then I might go to, I might go a little further than that. But these are kind of highlight verses, so to speak. So we're still in chapter 23. I happen to be on page 382 of the Schofield Reference Bible, and I'm reading from chapter 23, verse 1. Now these be the last words of David, David the son of Jesse, and the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, and then 2 and 3, as you have on your papers there, and then I'm going to go to 4. And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. Although my house be not so with God, yet he hath made me an everlasting covenant, the Davidic covenant, ordered in all things and sure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire, although he make it not to grow. A little more of the taste of what David is feeling. Very powerful stuff. Okay. The next item is very interesting. And I will admit that the first time I read about the census, I didn't quite understand what I couldn't quite grasp the issue with the census that David had taken. It took me a little bit of time. I have something very good, I think, will, for those of you who have read about it, weren't quite sure what was the impact of it. I think I have something that's very, very good in that regard. But in chapter 24, we see that in the first paragraph of chapter 24, the first paragraph, the first verse, and in Schofield's notation, he says David's sin in numbering the people, just ahead of chapter 24's verses, and then in verse 1 it says, and that's on page 383, and again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. For the king, David, said to Joab, the captain of the host, which was with him, go now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, and number ye the people, that I may know, David speaking, that I may know the number of the people. And Joab said unto the king, now the Lord thy God add unto the people, how many soever they may be, an hundredfold, and that the eyes of my lord the king may see it. But why doth my lord the king delight in this thing? Joab is questioning David's decision to take a census. And we'll get into why he's wondering why he wants to do that in just a minute. Notwithstanding, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the host. And Joab and the captains of the host went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. Okay. This is a problem. This is a problem. I want to read something that I find very interesting. This is really an article. It's not a commentary per se. It's succinct, and it speaks to it. I'm going to go going from this article into a couple of places in the Bible, so we can see. The gentleman who wrote this, his name happens to be Rick Phillips. I don't know him. I don't know what his thinking is on other matters like salvation and the gospel per se, but he does speak to why was David's census a great sin, and it was. And this is what Mr. Phillips says. Tonight I'm going to briefly handle three questions that have come to me recently. The first, the other two questions we don't care, they're not related. Why was it such a great sin for King David to order a census of Israel? And then, as we've just read, this refers to 2 Samuel 24, which we read part of, and he says, verses 1 to 17, we read the first few of those, where God's anger burned against Israel because David took a census of the fighting men, even Joab, David's thug general, he doesn't like him too much, okay, knew this would bring trouble, saying, why doth my lord the king delight in this thing? We just read that. As soon as David did it, he too knew it was a sin. God's wrath was so stirred up that 70,000 people died as a result. Interestingly, the biblical account never really explains why this was such a great sin. What makes this more interesting is that the chapter begins by saying the Lord incited David to do this, apparently by giving Satan permission to tempt him. The parallel account, and we're going to look at this, the parallel account, give me 1 second, I'll find the parallel account, 21. The parallel account in 1 Chronicles 21, let me get to it. This is interesting. If you're not familiar with it, I think you're going to find it quite interesting. Get to 21. Okay. In the first verse of chapter 21 of 1 Chronicles, this is what it says, very short. And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. That's as clear as bell. I don't know if there's any quarrel about that. So there you go. Satan tempted him. How did he do, David, on the temptation? Not so good. Not so good. He could have done a better job, like not doing it. Okay. Here's where the distinction occurs. We know that a census is taken all over the world. Censuses are taken routinely. No big deal, right? For all kinds of reasons. political jurisdiction reasons, funding reasons, it's endless, okay, in this country and other countries. I'll continue reading. The record in Chronicles places this right after a great victory over the Philistines, so the sin was probably related to a problem with pride and self-reliance. A census was preliminary. This is the key here. A census was preliminary to a draft of soldiers and a levying of taxes. It seems, therefore, that David's intent was to increase the royal power in a way that contrasted with the humble reliance on God. As Deuteronomy chapter 17 so strongly insists, the human kingship of Israel was to be noticeably dependent on God's divine kingship. for Israel's king to build up the same kind of power common to pagan kings was tantamount to repudiating God's over kingship. This seems to have been the nature of David's sin, so that God was angered and acted to nip it in the bud. I think it's right on the money. And I'm gonna make mention of one other thing if I can find it. I should put this on my phone. Look, we're using all this stuff here today. We're using paper, the Bible, screen, the phone. I hope it's still there. Now, this is in regard to a contrast between a census for this purpose, which I believe is accurate. What does your military need to be? How much are you supposed to levy in taxes? That's one reason for a census, okay? There are others, but that's one reason, major reason back in those days. But there also was another census taken in the time of Moses, and it's in Exodus chapter 30, beginning in verse 11. I have a commentary here by Matthew Henry. I've used Matthew Henry from time to time. Not everything that all commentators say can be taken easily sometimes. A grain of salt is always a good thing. Some commentaries are so off the mark, they make your hair stand up. But Henry is not, he's not so troublesome, okay? And very often he's right on the money. Matthew Henry was Welsh. He lived in the late 1600s to the early 1700s. And this is what he says in regard to the census that's in Exodus 30. Different ballgame. The rich were not to give more, nor the poor less. What an interesting way to state it, right? The rich were not to give more, and the poor not less. Which means what? Which means everybody gives the same, right? I mean, that's a kind of an interesting way to put it. The souls of the rich and the poor are alike precious, and God is no respecter of persons. In other offerings, men were to give according to their worldly ability, but this, which was the ransom of the soul, must be alike for all. The souls are all of equal value, equally in danger, and all equally need a ransom. We would all agree, right? Every single human being is no different. The money raised in this census was to be used in the service of the tabernacle. Those who have the benefit must not grudge the necessary charges of God's public worship. Money cannot make atonement for the soul, but it may be used for the honor of him who has made the atonement and for the maintenance of the gospel by which the atonement is applied. Now, I think that's very good. I like that very much. So you see the difference. So here's the census back in Exodus being used to support the tabernacle versus the one that we have here we've just described, which is a completely different purpose, strictly to really support the kingdom, the earthly kingdom of David. And so therein lies a huge distinction. Okay, let's see. Where are we now? So we just went through the sin. I'm going to find this right here. Just found the sins of the census. Okay, we just talked about that. So the census occurs. It's a mistake. Here we go again. So what does David do? As it says here, although David asked the Lord to punish only him and his family, God says, no, sorry. It's not just you. I'm going to have to punish Israel. And he does. He punishes Israel. And as it also says, David fell on God's decision. So there was the 3 days of pestilence, 70,000 people. Okay. All right. Reading along related, and it says here, David is told by God to buy Arauna's threshing floor on which to build an altar to the Lord. David will not take it as a gift. I mean, it's offered, but he won't. He won't take it as a gift. He will buy it. And David says in 2 Samuel 24:24, and the king said to Arauna, nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. Neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which doth cost me nothing. Wow. It seems like a simple thing. Okay, no, thank you very much. No, I have to buy it. And you think, well, he's just being nice, and he's being generous. He's actually paying for it. I mean, he's the king. He can literally take whatever he wants. And if someone offered it to him, what would be wrong with taking the gift? But that's a problem because of the last part of that sentence. Of that which doth cost me nothing. If anybody on the planet at the time could have appreciated cost, it would be him. This is just an extension of everything he's been through. His actions have cost him and his country an enormous amount. Okay? So is it finally sinking in? I think maybe it has. I think this small little phrase about a threshing floor is really telling. You know, it finally hit. It finally hit. I understand what's happened. I mean, I've understood what's happened all along, but it's kind of crystallized now, okay? I can't take it because I can't take it. It's cost me nothing. I've given so much. So many things have cost me so much. I do understand. No. Thank you. I can't do that. Okay. So in 2 Samuel 24:25, it says at the bottom there, and David built there an altar unto the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord was entreated for the land, and the plague was stopped. This is just my opinion. Again, it's more of what I've just said. The Lord wanted an action taken. He wanted an altar built. And he got that altar. But I think the more compelling part of this is the realization by David, full realization by David about what it really means. A small thing like that, like a threshing floor, what that means. And I think God clearly recognized that. Okay, we're getting near the end here, the literal end. In 1 Kings chapter 2, again, David is now, he is there. He is at the end of his life. And now he turns to his son Solomon, and this is what happens. Now the days of David drew nigh that he should die. And he charged Solomon, his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be thou strong, therefore, and show thyself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord thy God to walk in his ways. Does that happen? Not exactly. How difficult is it for all of us? Doesn't matter who you are, David, Solomon, take your pick. It's because we're all sinners. It's hard, you know? It's really hard. And it's going to be hard for Solomon, too. To keep his statutes and his commandments and his judgments and his testimonies. Wow, it's a lot. Okay? It's hard to do. It's really hard to do. Solomon is successful in some respects, of course, and completely unsuccessful in others, just like David. As it is written in the law of Moses, that thou mayest prosper in all that thou doest, and whithersoever thou turnest thyself, that the Lord may continue his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if thy children take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul There shall not fail thee, said he, a man on the throne of Israel. The Lord, of course, recognizes the frailty of man. The sin of man is very obvious. And because we all possess it, it's really how we handle it that matters most. We have it. What do we do about it? David was obviously smart enough to know that Solomon is going to experience many of the things, perhaps, that David did. He's prayerful, certainly, that that won't happen. And, you know, he says so clearly, keep his statutes, keep his commandments, keep his judgments, keep his testimonies. Please, please, I tell you this as I'm dying. You must do this. You must do this. It's a marvelous thing to tell your son who's going to be taking over. He's going to be commanding your kingdom. Who would know better? This is good advice. So here in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 10, David does die. So David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Although it's not archaeologically considered accurate, in Jerusalem, there is I have to call it a tourist attraction because I don't know what else to call it, and it's the Tomb of David. People come to the Tomb of David to see the Tomb of David because that's what it says it is. But there's no real support that that's the actual tomb. But people are elated to get in line and go in and say that they've been there. And we actually did that. We knew that that was not likely David's tomb, but you get caught up in the traveling around and you see it. So fortunately that day it wasn't very busy, which was good. But it's like other places in Jerusalem, like where Jesus was crucified. People have that all wrong, as many of us know. They picked the wrong location. We are convinced of where that occurred. Everything fits. Everything fits. The tomb fits. The skull formation above the tomb fits. The general location fits. So, we believe we were actually at the site where Jesus was crucified, to pay the full price for all of our sins. And of course, if we trust that he did that for us, we can have everlasting life and spend eternity with him in heaven. We pray that everyone here and those who are watching will place their full trust in the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross. Now, we are a little early, a few minutes, so that gives you time to stretch. And I thank everybody for bearing with me through the look at David. Next time around, which will not be next week because it's Father's Day and there will be no Sunday school next Sunday, but the following week will continue, and I think I did mention this last week, we're going to take a look at the gates of Jerusalem, which have just an incredible story about pretty much all of them, and we can learn a lot, not just about that, about the gates of Israel, but what they mean and what kind of history they've seen. It's interesting stuff. I think it's interesting. Hopefully you'll find it interesting. So that'll be the next one. I thank everybody.